From NPR and WBUR, I'm Scott Tong.
I'm Celeste Headlee. It's Here and Now. There are primary elections in New York State and Oklahoma today, as well as Florida, and that's where Republican governor and possible presidential candidate Ron DeSantis is running for re-election, and where incumbent Republican Senator Marco Rubio appears to be struggling to hold on to his seat. Steve Newborn is a reporter with WUSF in Florida. Hi, Steve.
Hi, glad to be here, Celeste.
Both DeSantis and Rubio are unopposed in today's primary, so let's begin with the Democrats. In the Democratic primary for governor, former Republican governor turned Democratic congressman Charlie Crist and Agriculture Commissioner Nikki Fried are battling it out. I wonder how much this Democratic primary is really about who can beat DeSantis.
Well, I think that is the whole thing is it's about that. The big thing here for the Democrats is to get enough name recognition to take on DeSantis, who has become this real powerhouse, which is interesting because 4 years ago when he was first elected, nobody really knew him, and he barely beat the Democrat challenger. So what we have here are two candidates who are trying to get through all that personality that we're hearing from DeSantis. So the establishment candidate is Charlie Crist. He's very well known in the state, kind of an old school politician, likes to shake your hand, pat you on the back. He's up against Nikki Fried. Now, she's the only statewide Democrat elected in Florida as the agriculture commissioner. As you know, the state has been trending more red lately. She doesn't have as much name recognition, but she has really latched on to the abortion issue. I mean, one of her ads shows Crist, when he was a Republican, calling himself pro-life.
Yeah.
So after this new 15-week abortion ban that DeSantis signed recently went into effect in Florida, she's really ramping up her persona as the only candidate who has always been pro-choice, the best choice to beat DeSantis in November.
So let's talk about that, how abortion is playing out in the race. DeSantis, as you mentioned, signed that 15-week abortion ban into law. His poll numbers have slipped a little since. Nikki Fried tweeted some remarks this morning.
We know that democracy is on this ballot, a women's right to choose is on this ballot, an affordability.
How do you see this playing out in the polls? How important is the issue of abortion for voters?
I think it's a really big motivator for the Democrats. It's getting people knocking on doors where they ordinarily wouldn't have. And on the Democratic side, this is the big issue. That and a lot of DeSantis's focus on the culture wars. He's taken on election laws, changed those. The treatment of transgender people has come under scrutiny. Yeah. And he signed what's called the Stop Woke Act, which targeted businesses that do training that includes critical race theory. So the Democrats are really latching on to abortion as the one big issue they think can cut through all the fog of all the culture wars that are coming from the Republican side.
Okay, since DeSantis may not be in the ballot, but he's making his voice heard in elections today. He has endorsed more than 30 school board candidates across Florida. And as you mentioned, he's making parental control in schools a big issue. Here he is speaking at a rally in Sarasota this past weekend.
Parents and I think students and I think Floridians want our school system to be about educating kids, not indoctrinating kids.
How powerful is his endorsement for candidates like these school board candidates?
I mean, he filled a little Shriners Hall with about 1,000 people. It's overflowing to capacity. Mm. And he's also taking the unprecedented step of having a PAC, the Friends of Ron DeSantis. And he has written checks to a lot of school board candidates, including two there in Sarasota County alone. And this is really whipping up the crowd, targeting legislation limiting how race and gender and sexual orientation are discussed in schools. So this is a big issue for the Republicans right now.
So as we mentioned, one of Florida's Senate seats is on the ballot this fall, Marco Rubio unopposed on the Republican side. But Congresswoman Val Demings is leading in the primary field for the Democrats. What do you think in the end, if she wins the primary, as she's expected to, what do you think this race will boil down to?
Yeah, Val Demings has just token opposition for the Democratic nominee. Now, she's a former police chief, and so the law and order issues are really coming front and center. Even though Ruby doesn't have any competition in the Republican primaries, already airing ads attacking her as woke, there's that word again, and attacking her as soft on crime and wanting to defund the police. Now, Demings is coming out saying this is nonsense. She has no desire to defund the police. So this is a really kind of an old-fashioned law and order campaign we're seeing here. It should be very interesting as we get closer to November.
Steve Newborn is a reporter with WUSF in Florida. Steve, thank you so much for your time.
Been a pleasure to be here.
Let's talk about the nation's long drought in the West and hydropower. Yesterday, Here and Now's Peter O'Dowd took us to Glen Canyon Dam in Arizona, where water levels are so low that it may stop producing hydroelectricity before long. So more broadly, what does climate change and drought mean for our overall energy picture in the U.S. and around the world? Reporter Umair Irfan of Vox has been writing about this, and we have him back on the show. Umair, hello.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So in the American West, we have seen this long drought, so there's not as much snow in the mountains to store water that goes into our rivers. Is this a cyclical thing where hydroelectric energy will bounce back, or is this a long-term shortage in hydro energy?
Well, what we're kind of seeing right now is sort of a drought within a drought. And so there's a seasonal drought or like a semi-annual drought that we're in right now that started in about 2020, and that's driving down water levels. But the West has been in a drying period that's been lasting the past 20 years. And so there's been a long-term decline in the water in the major reservoirs like the Colorado River and other kinds of, you know, waterways. And so we've been seeing sort of a steady decline in the water over these two decades, and that's having consequences for things like hydroelectric generation, but also knock-on effects for the energy sector writ large.
Of course, climate change is amplifying some of these patterns, but it's not just the energy supply, right? But also energy demand, it's getting hotter.
Right. You know, this summer we saw record demand in many cities in the Southwest and parts of Texas and parts of southwestern U.S. and Arizona and New Mexico, because with this extreme heat, you know, people need to cool off, and that means more air conditioners during the hottest times of day. But that also stresses the power grid, because then that means that there's less energy flowing through the power lines. Power lines are less efficient at higher temperatures, and the power plants themselves are also a lot less efficient at higher temperatures. So there's less energy being produced, the energy is being constrained, that's being transmitted, and there's a much more demand for it. And that leads to a recipe for basically putting the power grid much closer to the brink. Fortunately, we haven't seen the major blackouts here, but the stresses are only mounting.
And another dimension to this is other energy sources needing water, right? Power plants that run on coal and natural gas and nuclear, they also need water for cooling.
That's right. You know, it's really hard to overstate just how interconnected water and energy is. You know, you need energy to purify and, you know, ship water around the country. And it takes a lot of water to produce energy from the supplies, from things like hydraulic fracturing, which is the dominant source of oil and gas in the U.S. It takes about 4 million gallons of water to frack a well. And then you also need water to cool down power plants. Most plants in this country that generate electricity, more than 90%, are thermal power plants, which means they basically function on a heat exchange, which requires heat up water, but also cooling it back down. Mm-hmm. Most of those plants in the U.S. are what are called closed loops, so they recycle the water, but a significant fraction of them, about a third, are still using what are called once-through systems, where they take water from nature and put it back into nature. For the most part, that isn't really a big issue in normal temperatures, but when water temperatures get too high, then the power plant functions less efficiently, and sometimes they can't take in that water to cool off, and so they have to ramp down. And then if there's less water to begin with, you know, the power plant is also stressed if they don't have that cooling water. Then you end up in a scenario where, you know, just this drought is impacting every element of the energy sector.
Now, in this country, we're already seeing a dent in hydropower production in the West. What is the picture elsewhere in the world?
Right. You know, we're seeing a massive heat wave and drought in China as well. We're seeing some really extreme temperatures there. And, you know, the major rivers like the Yangtze River are at low levels, and it's making shipping fuel in and out hard. In Germany, similar story. The Rhine River, which is like the main route for shipping throughout the country. Germany's having trouble getting their oil and gas supplies into the country, and for coal. They're already facing an energy crunch right now because of the war in Ukraine, and they're trying to get off of Russian natural gas. Germany is the largest purchaser of natural gas in Europe, and so they're really aggressive about trying to switch to another energy source. And right now, those other energy sources are being stressed as well. But then in France, next door, you're also seeing power plants, nuclear power plants, shutting down because the water levels on the rivers that they're drawing water from are getting too warm. So with these high temperatures, as I said earlier, when you have hot water going into these power plants, they're less efficient. And with these nuclear power plants, it's gotten too hot for them to actually use that water. And their only option has been to shut down.
So for us, the energy users, what does this mean in the medium term, in the long term? If hydropower goes down, we need other sources to fill this gap, right? Otherwise, we could have scarcity, we could have rationing or brownouts.
You know, what this means is that, you know, we can't take energy or water for granted. Now, the good news is that there are a lot of technical solutions on all fronts that we can attack this problem from all sides. In the U.S. over the past few years, we've actually seen a decline in the amount of water we need to produce a given amount of energy. But we have to have policies and incentives to make people do that even faster. So dry cooling for power plants that uses less water, more energy efficiency, and just more being more thoughtful about how we deploy our cities and where people actually live to make sure that we're not putting people in the most dangerous parts of the country in the high stress times of year as we're running out of these resources.
That's Umair Irfan. He's a staff writer at Vox. Umair, thank you again.
Thank you for having me.
Hong Kong. To many of us far away, it sounds like this from CNN.
Protests on a weekly basis and clashes with police. That's become the new reality in Hong Kong.
But there is a lot more to Hong Kong. Say, the music of this local band. It's called David Boring. Our next guest writes about the sounds and the people of Hong Kong, like this band. Journalist Karen Chung is a Hong Kong native and millennial. Her book, The Impossible City, is a memoir about living in and through a tumultuous generation in Hong Kong, from the British handover to China in the 90s to protests and crackdowns in 2014 and 2019. I spoke to Karen Chung on Skype back in February. Your book is a lot about identity, your own and Hong Kong's identity. Your life overlaps with some of the most defining, perhaps traumatic moments in modern Hong Kong history in 1997. Your preschool age when the British handed back over to China. Then there are huge protests, of course, in 2014 and 2019, the latter resulting in crackdowns and losses of political freedoms in Hong Kong now. The question for you is, has that trauma given the people of Hong Kong and you identity of Hong Konger that they didn't really have before, you think?
That's a really great question, because I think for a lot of people, you know, Hong Kong identity is always something that's very difficult to pin down. And I can't necessarily say, you know, the past decade of political change or whatever, you know, has been the reason an identity has formed. But I do think that it is an opportunity for people to find a community, whether it's when you are in the warehouses and going to gigs with your friends, or when you're living through a big historical moment together, like in 2003 when we had SARS. So yeah, that is something that I think has contributed to the formation of the Hong Kong identity. But that is still, you know,
it's still ongoing.
Yeah, we're still trying to figure it out.
Yeah. Well, your stories of Hong Kong are intertwined with your own story in this memoir. You write about your father being emotionally abusive. You write about your mother leaving when you were very young. You were primarily raised by your grandmother. How did this upbringing, you think, shape who you became?
I think, you know, as a lot of people who didn't grow up knowing necessarily what home means to them, because, you know, home isn't necessarily a safe place. We tend to really try to figure out, okay, so what does it mean for me to belong somewhere? And a lot of these places around my neighborhood, or the people that I would see at the pier every day, for example, these people really became a sort of second family to me. And I think that really colors the way I look at the city, because there's a lot of discussions now about whether or not people are leaving because of the political situation. And a lot of my friends have left. And that is something that I am trying to interrogate, what it means to want to stay in this place, even though everyone is telling you, you know, that might not be for the best. Yeah. So I think that is a way that my family upbringing has influenced a lot of the material that is in the book, and also my relationship with the city itself.
Well, let me ask you about what it's like now. You mentioned people who are leaving, the political freedoms have significantly eroded the last year or two. What is it like?
I think that's a difficult question to answer because the lines have been shifting so constantly. I think a very overt influence it had on me and the people around me is that my background is in journalism, and a lot of my friends continue to be reporters today. And over the past year, you know, the space for reporting stories has shrunk a lot. Papers have closed down, and that becomes something that's very difficult for us to navigate. Sometimes we would have conversations about, you know, what can we still write that is quote unquote safe? You know, we don't know what that really means. And if we have something that we want to write, what kind of publication would be willing to run it? And at the same time, I think a lot of us who are still here, our mental health isn't the best. There have been a lot of collective moments of trying to, in a way, grieve together and holding each other and being like, okay, what are we going to do next? What sort of future do we have left?
Yeah, let me ask you about grieving and mental health, because you write about that throughout your book with your own experiences and challenges. In 2014, there are huge protests in Hong Kong that come to be called the Umbrella Revolution. Here's a bit of a report from NBC's Katie Tour.
Protesters, mostly students, are demanding full democracy.
You were born with democracy choices. You have free election right, but we don't. Please help us.
You write that after 2014 and political rights kind of don't change, universal suffrage, which had been promised, does not seem to be moving toward happening. You write that Hong Kong, or meant for many people in Hong Kong, they went into years of depression. What do you mean?
I think that that shrinking of that space of possibility of what we dreamt could be the future of the city, that was a huge blow to a lot of people. And, you know, as I write in the book as well, the mental health system here isn't really equipped to deal with large amounts of patients. And it became sort of a struggle for a lot of people to figure out where they could air a lot of these thoughts. But at the same time, you know, there's been a lot of positive things as well. A lot of people took that negative energy and they turned it into a lot of wonderful things. So there's been a lot of grassroots movements. There's been a lot of people who decided that they were going to focus on really hyper-local politics on a district level, which is just improving the lives of the neighbors. So that was, I think, generally what the mental health situation was. People were depressed generally, but there were a lot of moments that gave people a lot of hope.
For us far away, Hong Kong is so often defined by the great powers that are moving it one direction or another, because it's a British colony after 1842, right? And then the Japanese occupy Hong Kong, and then it reverts to colonial Britain, and then it becomes part of communist China. But you take us to the people who are being influenced by all these kind of the great power moments. And for you, something that is very personal is music. And one of your groups that you write about is My Little Airport. Tell us briefly what the Hong Kong music scene means to you and defining Hong Kong people.
When I was 18, 19, I started going to these underground music shows in Hong Kong for the first time. And I found out that in all these industrial buildings left over, and there's a lot of them and it's scattered throughout Hong Kong because we used to be an industrial city. And these places and spaces are really where a lot of the underground music movement and also the artists have found a home in. And when I found out that these places existed for the first time, it was like, oh, this is what I'm looking for, because I always thought that Hong Kong didn't have these things. You know, it was just the pop scene. And yeah, for instance, David Boring, I think something about them is they're so angry. And because of that, it's so cathartic to listen to. I remember just so many times where I would just go to a show, and before that, I would be in, you know, maybe a state of brain fog where I couldn't understand really reality around me. And I would just go there and I would feel very alive and I would feel like I've expelled demons out of my body or something. Mm-hmm. And I always have that experience whenever I go to their shows. And that's why I really wanted to talk to them for the book, because they've been so important and their music has been so important to me.
Well, finally, Karen, I want to ask you where you and your relationship with Hong Kong goes from here. You write that at some point, if Hong Kong no longer makes sense to you, or maybe the identity is no longer there in a way that you identify with, you would leave. How do you think about that now?
I think staying is maybe not the answer, but I'm not sure moving is either for me, because I can't really imagine what it's like to care about a place that isn't home for me. And I know people move all the time and you find new reasons to make that place feel like it is a part of you. But I think because there's still so many young creatives and artists and musicians here, when I get to see them and hang out with them and experience their art, I feel like there's these moments of transcendence that triumphs over the depression. And as long as I think they're still here, I want to be here for as long as I can. And I really don't know what that looks like in terms of time, because things are moving so quickly. But for now, I just can't imagine being anywhere else. You know, I wrote this book because I didn't know what it means to forget a place. And I was so worried that I wouldn't know how to remember the place that I knew anymore. And I hope that even as all these things are happening here, there are going to be a lot of historical documents to archive the way of life that was here for the time that I grew up, and they were the people who made this place so vibrant and alive for me. And I think that can never be touched in a way, even as a lot of things disappear.
Karen Cheung is the author of The Impossible City, a Hong Kong memoir. Karen Cheung, thank you for taking the time.
Thank you so much, Scott.
Imagine you're at a restaurant or a coffee shop and you pay with your card. And there at the bottom of the screen or the receipt is a suggestion for how much to tip. Have you noticed that the suggested tip amounts have gone up lately? Well, they have at some businesses. Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure, has been looking into what's behind the rise in tipping options. Hi, Robin.
Hi, Celeste. How are you?
I'm well. Okay, so it appears some restaurants are asking for higher tips. How much are they asking for, and why is it going up?
Well, let's be fair. The default right now is this kind of tablet system. You recognize it. Toast. What is the other one? Square. These things where the barista or whoever it is at the counter kind of flips it around and you pay and you swipe your credit card. That's for carryout service. But increasingly, people at Chili's or casual type restaurants are paying on the tablets. And these things default to tipping options, oftentimes 15, 20, 22, 25% or more. And the frustration is this idea of guilt tipping when you're being looked at by a barista or a counter person or a server, and you really are, you know, especially with a carryout transaction, if you buy a $6 muffin and coffee or something, a lot of people are frustrated on TikTok. They're saying, why do I have to tip if the price has already gone up? It's up to the store owner to sufficiently pay living wages.
Okay, so does this strategy of increasing the suggested tip mean that these workers are getting higher wages, or what's the downside here?
The problem is it's not always flowing through to workers. In fact, you're seeing some people on TikTok, if you go and notice the trend, some workers saying that I'm really frustrated that the manager is pushing me to prompt the tip. And in reality, it's not always going to me. It's going to a general fund in the store. And my wages are still clocked at the old, you know, tip per hour rate. And there's a lot of confusion about it. People feel guilt on both ends. If you remember, Celeste, at the beginning of the pandemic, there was hero wages, people showing up at places. A lot of the restaurants we frequented, we were buying gift cards that we thought we would never use because we wanted those restaurants to stay open. And so I think these owners of the restaurants, the proprietors, they made overtures to that. They wanted to say that thank you for helping us keep our staff online. And a lot of that has not discontinued now, 2.5 years into this, and people are feeling guilt on both ends.
Okay, so according to research released by Toast, the company you mentioned, they provide a lot of restaurant card services. The percentage of bills that goes to tips has remained fairly constant even as prices rise. Why has that remained constant?
Prices have gone up. The percentage has remained constant. A lot of times this isn't flowing to workers, and there is some resentment that, you know, why should I have to pay if you're already charging me more for inflation, if the price of dairy and everything else has gone up and you're paying workers more? It feels like double jeopardy. So there isn't transparency. There's opacity. You see the Starbucks workers who are protesting are frustrated at the lack of a default tip option. I think that this is going to continue, and until and unless you see more transparency about how much of the bill is going to workers. And I don't think that customers are against paying workers. They just don't want this diffusion of responsibility from management.
Robin Farzad is host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Thanks, Robin.
My pleasure. Thank you.
So what do Miles Davis, Marvin Gaye, and Aretha Franklin have in common? Well, besides being three of the biggest musical artists of the 20th century, they all recorded at United Sound Systems in Detroit. The 1916 brick building that houses the studio was designated a historic landmark in 2015, but local preservationists are worried that may not be enough to protect it forever. Michelle Jara McKinney is with the Detroit Sound Conservancy, which is a nonprofit that's fought to save United Sound. Michelle, thanks for being here.
Oh, I am so pleased to be here.
So it's incredible the number of recordings that were made in this studio. What's Going On from Marvin Gaye, everybody from Charlie Parker to the Red Hot Chili Peppers came through. I want to take a listen to just one recording made here. Here is Whitney Houston and Aretha Franklin singing "It Isn't, It Wasn't, It Ain't Never Gonna Be." So, Michelle, what makes this studio so special?
Well, what makes it so special is that it is the voice of this community. It actually adapted a residential space and turned it into this place where people could come to in the inner city. Also, what was special about the studio was that they didn't spend money on electronic stuff. They got their studio engineers to invent stuff. So a lot of the equipment that is used now all over the world, a lot of it was invented at the United Sound. What also made it special was that Don Davis, he came and brought in all of these voices. Besides, of course, Berry Gordy had been there. He learned his chops about how to mix things and stuff. He would just sit there and watch the producers. And then, inspired by that house business, he went and created the Motown over there on the Boulevard. And then when Motown left, United Sound Studio was still doing it till it closed down. It brought people like Aretha and Whitney together and a whole host of wonderful artists. So it's quite a distinctive and innovative place where the modern sound that redefined music all over the world was created.
There's so many stories associated with this studio. I mean, number one, it's maybe a mile away from the Motown studios. And Don Davis himself, we could talk about him the entire time. I mean, if people want to hear him playing guitar, I think he played on Money, That's What I Want, an early Motown record. The best things in life are free, but you can give them to the birds and bees. I need fun. That's what I want. 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 Your love. But this building itself, which predated Don Davis, and the studio itself, has very narrowly escaped destruction. a few times. Just a few years ago, the Michigan Department of Transportation bought that building. They had planned an expansion of the interstate, Interstate 94 there, and it would have gone straight through the lot. How did escape destruction?
Well, the Detroit Sound Conservancy went and sat in all of those public meetings, and they advocated for it. And that's one thing that the Detroit Sound Conservancy does. We do placekeeping, which means we preserve places that Detroiters have made special, such as the Bluebird Inn. But the United Sound System Studios, when we heard that MDOT bought it and they were going to knock it down, oh no, that was war. So that we went to every single public meeting. Now MDOT is talking about just moving it, but that's not saving it. That to me. Because
you're afraid it would get damaged in the move?
Yes, and plus, some of the studios are in the basement. So to me, saving it would mean that some wonderful benefactor will come and say, let's use this as a museum and as a recording studio again.
Yeah, it should still be recording.
Let's make it, it still has those studios in there, man.
You talked about the Bluebird Inn, which for people who don't know, that was... Many people think of that as the birthplace of bebop, jazz. And as you said, you guys are now rehabilitating the Bluebird Inn, and I think also rehabilitated the Bird Stage.
Yes.
The thing is for me is that there's a couple forces here that are quite powerful, and especially in Detroit, and one is cars. I mean, you're talking about a city that is expanding its interstates constantly. That city is addicted to its vehicles, right? You're not going to pry the cars away from people in Detroit. But the other thing about Detroit is that it has such a history of disrespecting the architecture that was a huge part of Black communities. I mean, this is also another city in which, looking back through history, they torn down an entire Black neighborhood in order to put an interstate through it.
Yes.
How do you view sort of the context of trying to preserve this history and I guess this war between the car and Black history?
You know, it's so funny that, this systemic racism has a lot to do with it. And the fact that we have another world-class industry here, which is music. That is amazing to me that the city doesn't celebrate and invest more in that industry. That's how we got that Detroit sound. So a lot of that's gone now, but we're going to bring it back. That's what we're doing with the Bluebird Inn.
I just want to play a little more music here because if I were to actually list off all the musicians that are recorded at United Sound, it would, first of all, take a very long time, but it would blow people's minds. But you can hear jazz from Miles Davis, blues from John Lee Hooker. Let's take a little bit of a listen to John Lee Hooker.
Yeah, my mama, she didn't love me. She had to stay out all night long. Oh, Lord. Well, my mama didn't love me. She had to stay out all night long.
So that's one of his earliest hits, if you can call it at the time. That's Boogie Chillin'. You heard funk from Parliament, soul artists like Isaac Hayes. They also recorded a lot of TV jingles and radio ads there.
Yes, that's how they got their reputation.
So why this, Michelle? Of all the things in the world that need your time and your energy and your passion, why the United Sound Systems studio?
I think that studio would bring hope. And I believe that if we could get that to be functional again, if MDOT would sell it to someone who could really bring it back, I think that would be a monstrously wonderful event. So to me, the United Sound Studios would be an excellent institution to reestablish here in Detroit. and do it the Detroit way.
I'm sure it wouldn't make up for the long-ago destruction of both the Black Bottom and the Paradise Valley neighborhoods, but it would be incredible if you were able to save United Sound Studio. And what do you need in order to do it?
We need a sponsor. We need a benefactor. Someone with deep pockets. So why not have more on the tourism? Because that's what's happening over at the Motown Museum. They're expanding, and they're number one tourist stop. United Sounds could be that too.
Michelle Jara McKinney of the Detroit Sound Conservancy. Michelle, thank you so much for all you do.
And thank you for having me. Thank you.
Here's one more classic track recorded at United Sound, Flashlight by Parliament. We asked MDOT for an update on their plans, and a spokesman told us they have, quote, no desire to demolish nor operate the sound studio and will continue to work with the State Preservation Office to ensure that when the facility goes to public auction, there's a covenant in the deed requiring that some portion of the building remain operating as a recording studio. We understand the historical and community significance of United Sound, and our purchase was done to preserve this iconic facility.
In eastern Maine, one family wants to honor American veterans by building the world's tallest flagpole on their own land. The idea is to attract visitors to Maine and perhaps lure a few away from veterans' memorials in Washington, D.C. But as Maine Public Radio's Nicole Ogrisco reports, the fate of this project could be up to some 500 residents living near the intended site. And not all of them are on board.
It's not easy to get to the site of the massive Veterans Memorial Park that Morrill Wooster and his sons have spent more than a decade dreaming up.
This is a pretty good vantage point right here.
Project manager Rob Wooster navigates his pickup through winding roads on his family's sprawling property, past rolling blueberry fields and forest. He stops at a chain-link fence dividing a network of rough dirt paths just wide enough for his truck to head deeper into the woods. He then pulls into a small clearing, steps into an off-road vehicle, and maneuvers it up rough terrain. There are moose tracks in the dirt.
That's the other thing that's kind of neat. I think, you know, there's going to be a lot of people here, but it's so spread out, and I think we can kind of work with the environment, and I think people will come here and see moose.
It's here, at the top of this hill in one of Maine's poorest counties, where the Woosters envision their flagpole of freedom to stand, slightly taller than the Empire State Building, at more than 1,400 feet. The flag itself will be the size of 1.5 football fields, the largest ever flown. Visitors could take a series of elevators to two observation decks. At the top, they'll have panoramic views of Acadia National Park and even Nova Scotia, Canada, Wooster says.
This area is in the flight path to Europe. We wanted this giant symbol of freedom for people that are coming here by plane. You know, you're going to see this is the first thing you see when you come over the states. And when people are being deployed, it'll be the last thing you see and the first thing you see when you come back from your deployment.
The massive project calls for more than a flagpole. It would also include remembrance walls with the names of 24 million deceased U.S. veterans. 6 miles of gondolas would take visitors to hiking trails, immersive history exhibits, and a 4D theater. It carries a price tag of $1 to $2 billion for the first phase. That would be raised through private contributions and corporate sponsorships.
Considering what we're trying to do in the scale of this, you know, $1 billion is a lot of money, but it really... I think it's a deal.
The Woosters want the first phase up and running by the nation's 250th birthday on July 4th, 2026. But how quickly it's developed may be up to the small town of Columbia Falls. That's because earlier this spring, the Maine legislature quietly passed a bill authorizing the transfer of more than 10,000 acres of the family's property in unorganized territory to Columbia Falls. That's contingent on a referendum by the town's residents to annex the land. If passed, Columbia Falls would get oversight of the project. The founders will also need permits and approval from several state agencies.
I cannot begin to tell you how just massive this the amount of work that needs to be done on behalf of the town in order for the town to be prepared for a project of this magnitude.
Roger Huber is an attorney who's helping the town of Columbia Falls understand the annexation process and the project itself. He's assembling a team of land use planning experts and more attorneys who will help the town study the project's impacts. Once the park is built, the Worcesters believe it'll bring more than 8,000 jobs to the region. Those jobs include staffing for the park, as well as for new hotels, restaurants, and public works facilities that will need to be built to support the project. It'll also require more housing and an expansion of local schools and roads to accommodate more people.
Good. We hope so. I mean, that's the point. And people say it's going to change who we are. Well, yes, maybe it'll change us back into who we once were.
Chris Gardner, chairman of the Washington County Commissioners, acknowledges the flagpole project will generate some challenges for the region. But he says the county wants to build an economy around the park, and he believes the infrastructure will come in time. At a meeting in June, about 40 to 50 people gathered at the Columbia Falls Town Hall to hear more about the Worcesters' plans. Like Gardner, some residents said they welcome the development as a way to bring much-needed economic opportunities to their families. But others, like Roberta Hammond, are not on board.
We have wonderful memorials in Washington, D.C. for our veterans. And I just hate to see the treasure that we have here in Washington County lost, because we'll never get it back again.
Columbia Falls Town Selectmen say they won't schedule a vote on annexation until they've gathered enough information to satisfy local residents. The Worcester's attorney says they're prepared to move forward with the project, with or without annexation. For Here and Now, I'm Nicola Grisco.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Scott Tong.
And I'm Celeste Headley. It's Here and Now.